This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book looking at the turbulent history of mental health treatment in the United States and how it shapes the way we handle mental illness today. Now, sometimes you see a movie and you really like it, and that's it. You're done with it. But sometimes, if you're like me, you go back and watch it again. And maybe it doesn't stop there. You rewatch again and again over the years. Maybe it's not even the best movie. It could be a comfort film for you. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What is a movie that you keep watching time and time again? What is it you like about it? Do you have traditions attached to it with the family on a holiday when you're in a particular mood? How many times have you watched the movie? Has it changed over the years, your go-to re-watches? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go right to a caller to start things off. Rod is with us in La Crescent, Minnesota. Rod, hi.
Hello, sir. I'd say definitely the outlaw Joseph Wales, Clint Eastwood.
Sure.
And just about any Elvis movie, too, you know what I mean?
Elvis movies. Now, wait, are you doing a little Elvis right now?
No, I've just been doing Elvis for about 15 years, you know what I mean? And he's a very good friend of mine.
All right. Can I presume, Rod, to ask you to just give us one line of vocals, sing a little bit for us?
I'll try and do that, sir. Yes and no, never come home at night. Kiss me, my darling, remind so tonight. Now, tomorrow will be too late. Yes, no, never.
Now, Rod, I've heard rumors that Elvis is still alive. Are you the real deal?
I'm trying to live out here in the country and hiding out. You know what I mean? I really wouldn't like to sit there and get my place up, but otherwise, Minnesota is a very nice little place, and Nashville was okay, but. Everybody sit there and they're taking on me and calling my name and trying to kiss me. You know what I mean?
I hear you. Rod, thanks so much for getting us started. Rod, quote, I love live radio. This is awesome. We're asking for your favorite movie to re-watch again and again. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Bruce joins us now in Iron County. Bruce, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What are your re-watches?
Well, I've got three just kind of off the top of my head. My number one is Django, and I know the language and the substance is a little harsh, but I just find that period of time fascinating and how people treated other people. And I think DiCaprio and Christoph Waltz do a great job in that film. My number two is Inglourious Basterds with Brad Pitt, another Tarantino film.
Yep.
And then number three is just a classic, The Godfather, one or two. Watched them all a number of times, and I love them. Thanks for your time.
Bruce, thank you so much for sharing those at 800-642-1234. We asked around here at WPR and PBS Wisconsin. Marion Herzog, an audience services specialist at PBS Wisconsin, picked Ocean's 11. Now, this is the George Clooney, Brad Pitt one. Marion says it's one of my favorite movies of all time. I could put it on basically any time, still enjoy it. Love the snappy dialogue and the cinematography and the chemistry between the two main boys. Probably seen it 12 to 15 times. That is one I have watched a couple few times. My kids, too. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Mineral Point. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What's your rewatch movie?
The Replacements with Keanu Reeves and Gene Hackman.
I don't remember, though. I have seen that zero times. Okay, go ahead. Not a great movie, you say.
It's not an award-winning movie, but it's one of those where the underdog wins. Everybody looked like they had fun making it. It's just, I don't know, it just makes us feel good every time we watch it.
Interesting. What made that one stand out as well? Because you're saying, that's maybe not the best movie ever. And I think this is probably true for a lot of people. It's maybe not the best movie, but there's something about it that brings you back to it.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, my husband and I both enjoy football, but it was just, I guess it's the underdog part of it. Mm. But again, we're both Hackman fans, and it just looked like they were having fun. Some of the lines in it are just, we quote them all the time. If we're scrolling through the TV screen and it's on, we usually stop right there and watch it.
Fantastic. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that. We are asking you about your favorite movie or movies to watch again and again. What do you like to rewatch? Is there something you watch maybe a particular holiday every year when you get together with family or friends? 800-642-1234. Rachel Vasquez, producer on Central Time. One of her favorite newer movies to rewatch is Disney's Coco, a beautiful movie, Rachel says, with a great message, really awesome music. My three-year-old niece Luna, Rachel says, is the one who got me into it. She's a very big fan. One of the main reasons I love it, because it makes me think of my abuelita, who passed away years ago, who I miss a lot. We've got a little clip here without giving away a plot. This is from Coco, where the main character Miguel sings to his grandma a song passed down through their family.
So as of right now, this is a...
Nope, that's not the right clip. We'll figure that out, and we'll go back to your calls in the meantime at 800-642-1234. I was expecting singing there. Tom is with us in northern Wisconsin. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your movie, Tom?
My movie is Casablanca, one of the best of all times, I think. Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, two great actors. Plus an exotic locale, suspense, love, and fighting against the Nazis. It's got it all.
All right. And, Tom, I got to ask, because one of my rewatches is adjacent to that, The Maltese Falcon. Compare and contrast. Do you like that one, too?
I do. I like everything that Bogart was in.
Excellent. Tom, thanks so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. John joins us now in Chippewa Falls. John, hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. What is your rewatch?
Well, you may not consider it a movie, but if anytime it's on, Lonesome Dove.
Oh yeah, the miniseries. Sure, we'll call that a movie.
Yes. Yeah. I don't care if it's on Tuesday and then again on Friday, I'll watch it.
And that how long is that whole thing put together?
I think about 10 hours.
Okay. Wow. If you start it, do you have to finish it over the next week or so?
Oh, yes, most definitely. I'll binge watch it. In fact, my son's bought me I have the CDs of the whole compilation, but I don't watch that. I wait for it to come on TV.
Oh,
and,
funny.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great performers in that, John. Do you have a favorite actor or role in Lonesome Dove?
Oh, Robert Duvall.
Okay, I was going to guess Robert Duvall.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just something about him, the way he is with the ladies and... No.
John, thanks a lot. Lonesome Dove, great pick. Let's go now to Cody in Chautauqua. Cody, hi.
Hey,
no,
you're
in Chautauqua. Okay, I got it. I we had a funky spelling, but Chautauqua. Cody, what's up?
Not much. How about you?
Good. Not much. What is your movie?
I'd have to say mine would probably be Saving Private Ryan.
Ooh, that's pretty intense, man. What is it about Saving Private Ryan that keeps you coming back?
I don't know. I think it's just the firsthand look you get to see, you know, what they all went through and how they were fighting and all the little stuff they tried to do to keep an edge on the enemy, you know, and just right up there up front and just makes you appreciate everything everybody's doing and just,
gotcha.
You know, it's crazy. It gets you right in the feelers.
You know, that reminds me, one of my daughters, for some reason, latched onto the movie Dunkirk, the like early World War II movie, you know, the evacuating British troops from France. It's super intense. Have you seen that one? You could add that to your list.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out.
Dunkirk. Yeah, definitely. Cody, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Asking you for your favorite movies, miniseries, I guess if you want to throw in a TV series, to watch again and again over the years. Tim joins us next in Hollandale. Tim, hello.
Best movie ever made was Where Were You in 1962, American Graffiti.
American Graffiti. Okay. What is it that keeps you coming back? Why is that your best movie?
It's all the muscle cars from the era I wish I was born in and wasn't. So it's just the interaction between the people, the drag racing, you know, just kind of the way, only a little bit of the way it was when I went to school, but... Didn't have that quite a cool cars.
And that was George Lucas, right? Of Star Wars fame, who directed that?
No, it was, I think it was.
Cool. All right, Tim, that is a great one. We are asking you to share your favorite movies to watch again and again. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with yours, or if you encounter a busy phone line, you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Got an email from Leah who writes, I can rewatch You've Got Mail over and over. Makes me think I can just pick up and move to the Upper West Side and wait for one anticipated email a day. And Jill Nadeau from The Larry Mueller Show also picks You've Got Mail, says it's a perfect remake of an old movie called Shop Around the Corner. You can join in again, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. That song from Coco, a favorite movie to rewatch for Rachel Vasquez of Central Time. We are asking for your favorite movie or movies to rewatch again and again, maybe over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Stuart is with us in Madison. Stuart, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my favorite movie to watch over and over again is this movie called Flight of Dragons from the 80s.
I was in the 80s. I don't remember that one. Tell me about it, Stuart.
Yeah, so it's the same animators from the animated Lord of the Rings movies. It's got John Ritter and James Earl Jones. It's just really, really cheesy fantasy stuff. And my buddy in like ninth grade had a copy on VHS, and nice. We would just always watch that movie over and over again.
Cool. And you still watch it?
Oh, yeah. I have a copy on my computer, always ready to go.
Do you share it with other people who may not have that attachment to it? If so, what is their response?
I do. Some people either absolutely love it or they think it's the worst movie they've ever seen.
That's awesome, Stuart. Thanks so much for sharing that. The memory, too. That's so important. Thank you for calling in at 800-642-1234. Jay joins us now in Milwaukee. Jay, hello.
Hi.
What's your movie or movies?
Well, there's four of them that I really love. Z, If, King of Hearts, and Harold and Maude.
Oh, Harold and Maude. Now, that was one of my wife's for a long time. She just recently, like in the last 2 months or so, rewatched Harold and Maude for the first time in years. What is it about that movie? I think that's a pretty common one for people to come back to.
It's a quirky movie, and it's got a very interesting sense of humor, and it's got a very interesting story. Plus, I love Cat Stevens' music.
Excellent. Yeah, there's a lot of Cat Stevens in that. Thanks for calling in, Jay, at 800-642-1234. Again, we asked around Wisconsin Public Media. Colleen Leahy from Central Time, producer, says, I'm not much of a rewatcher, but in French class in high school, our teacher made us watch Groundhog every year on Groundhog Day. So Colleen says, I've seen Groundhog Day 4 times in French. Not a fan. Back to your calls with the movies you actually enjoy watching again and again. Terry is with us in Milwaukee. Terry, hi.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. I love movies with principles. So my three picks, my top picks are It's a Wonderful Life, A Walk in the Clouds, and Frequency.
Now, It's a Wonderful Life, that's a real seasonal movie. Are you somebody who will watch it just, you know, in December, or is that one you'll watch any time of year?
No, you know, actually, I've never, even since the first time I've watched it, I've never viewed that movie as a Christmas movie.
Okay.
I just felt that it taught some powerful principles about a person's life and how they should not take for granted the impact that they have on other people.
Wonderful, Terry. Thank you so much. That's a great reason to rewatch movies, I think. Let's go to Preacher Kate in Madison. Preacher Kate, hi.
Good morning. It's morning somewhere.
Good morning, sure. Why not?
Why not? My top two favorite movies are Frozen River with Melissa Leo and Misty Upham. There was a woman producer and a woman director, and I don't remember their names, but it's a fabulous movie. And then my other one would be I'm drawing a blank. It's with Alfie Woodard and Mary McDonald's Passion Fish.
I was going to say, I'll cheat. You told our producer Passion Fish. Now, are these ones you'll pull out any time, or is there a particular like circumstance in which you'd watch these movies again?
Oh, anytime I want.
Excellent.
When I need a movie and I want to watch it, you know, I'll pull out one of those. And I've actually got two copies of each. And I have two copies of Harold and Maude and Young Frankenstein. And I pass them out to people. I bought them up when the video places were closing.
Oh, good thinking. Thank you so much. That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us. We heard from a couple people here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Michelle Good said, Frida, first of all, with Salma Hayek about Frida Kahlo, the artist. And we had a couple people mention Pride and Prejudice. That was Michelle and scrolling. Oh, Eva Marley, a membership specialist, the Keira Knightley, Matthew McFadden version of Pride and Prejudice. Eva said they had a habit of waking up at 3 a.m. on weekends to study and found that the film was just entertaining enough to keep us awake, but not so distracting we couldn't get work done. Well, as soon as we heard from two people, here's a listen to the Keira Knightley Pride and Prejudice.
If, however, your feelings have changed, I would have to tell you. You have bewitched me, body and soul, and I love, and love, and love you. I never wish to be parted from you from this day on.
You know, I finally read the book a couple years back, Pride and Prejudice. I really liked it. I should check out some of the movie incarnations. Let's go back to your calls now with your movies to watch again and again and again. Lori is with us in Milwaukee. Lori, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Lori? What movie do you have?
So I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but my movies that I will not turn off and just get excited when I see them come on are Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers with Ben Stiller.
Sure. Why be embarrassed? I say don't be embarrassed. What is it about those? They're funny movies, right?
They're funny movies, but it's just not what I would normally watch. So my wife has even been like, are you watching this again? And so, yeah, in our family, it's just kind of a joke when they see it on the TV. It makes me feel good. Makes me smile.
No judgment here, Lori. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Trevor is with us now in Milwaukee. Trevor, what is your movie?
Hello. My movie that I like to rewatch a lot is Alien. Not quite sure which year, but with Sigourney Weaver, the first one specifically.
I don't remember the exact year, but I was young enough to where it probably scared me more than it might have if I'd been a little older than I watched it. I love that one. Now, Alien, you know, the aliens and the movies that came after were really different. Is there something about the first one in particular that made you latch onto it?
The first one is like such a great fantasy sci-fi, like existential horror movie on the like inside, and you know, like monster, great actions like on the outside. The first one encapsulates all of it so well. And it's like, on a bad day, I'll just watch that movie and be like, yeah, my life's not that hard.
Yeah, I guess could be worse. You could have, you could be John Hurt in Alien.
And the practical effects in the first movie for the time are amazing. Outstanding.
Alien. Trevor, thank you so much for that. John joins us now in Stevens Point. John, you've got a movie for us.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I like Repo Man. I think that's one that I go back to kind of more than maybe I should, but.
Well, I blame society, John, but it still hurts. That's Repo Man, right?
Yeah,
just off the top of my head there. Yeah, I haven't seen that in years either, but I think that's like people consider that a cult film. I think a lot of people are in your boat rewatching it. What is it about Repo Man for you?
I like the balance of kind of surreal, but also when it came out, it sort of was about where I was at. You know, so it was like it was the characters sort of reminded me of punk rocker people that I knew and stuff. So it was, nice. It kind of just fit. And then it was also had Dennis Hopper. So that doesn't hurt either.
Never go wrong with Dennis Hopper in a movie. John, thanks for that call. Dean is with us next in Eau Claire. Dean, hello.
Hi. A movie called Jeremiah Johnson is my favorite. I would watch it at least once a year, starring Robert Redford. I think it was back in 1972 or 1973.
And what is it about that one that latched you onto it?
The cinematography is excellent. It's got a really neat story about a a fellow who I believe comes out of the Civil War, but I'm not exactly sure. But he goes out west and decides to try to be a mountain man.
Excellent. Dean, thank you for sharing. And Robert Redford's not a bad actor, right? He's all right.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Dean, thanks a lot for calling in. We are asking for your movies to rewatch. Time for a couple more of your calls. Courtney is with us in Shell Lake. Courtney, what do you have for us?
Circle of Friends with Minnie Driver and Chris O'Donnell.
Okay. I haven't seen that one myself. Give us a little taste of it. What is it? Why did it grab you?
Oh, it takes place in Ireland, and the cinematography is beautiful, and it's a lovely story about friends.
Great. And Ireland always gives you something to look at.
Yes, you can enjoy The Quiet Man at St. Patrick's Day every year, too.
Excellent. Courtney, thanks a lot for sharing that. Luann is on the line now in Green Bay. Luann, what is your rewatch movie?
It's Dave with Kevin Kline. It's, I think, the best political movie ever, and especially lately, I've been watching it and rewatching it and rewatching it.
Yeah, that's he. I don't think it's giving too much away. He ends up having to stand in for a president who he looks just like, but he's a normal dude.
Absolutely. But no, he's an honorable guy.
Right.
Let's just put it that way.
Right. That is one I remember my parents and my little brother rewatching it. I watched it a time or two. That is a great one, Luann. Time for one more call. Heath is with us on the road. Heath, what are you going to share with us?
Well, I'm going to say Grumpy Old Men because that is just a Midwest movie. It makes me feel good at the great actors.
And just across the river in Minnesota, Wabasa, Minnesota, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Excellent. Heath, thank you so much. Hey, thanks to everyone. Oh, more people are still calling in. We'll do this again sometime. Keep sharing your favorite movies to rewatch. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We can keep sharing your rewatchable movies through the course of the week. And we've got some more from our colleagues here at Wisconsin Public Media as well. Again, share your movies to rewatch on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and I'll share them, if any, on the air. Coming up, oh, by the way, we'll talk about new movies this Thursday. We'll look at the hot films of summer 2022 with our friend Reggie, the Real Critic. And tomorrow on the morning show, fire up the grill, get some great cookout advice, join with your own secrets and your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we listened back to an interview with Erica Okrent, a linguist, about her book, Highly Irregular, looking at some of the weird quirks of the English language, how they came to be. We heard from some more of you when we played it back. John from Madison says, I met a guy in Puerto Rico who said spelling was the hardest part of learning English. Agree. And in Spanish, grammar is the hardest part. I think I agree with that, too. And John wondered why the word walk has an L in it and why write, like writing things down, starts with a W. Now, I looked it up in the book. She mentions walk. The L is there because we used to pronounce it with the L. Walk. Walk this way. I guess talk this way. That faded over time. Spelling never caught up. And Stella from Sturgeon Bay listens to Books on Tape from England and notices the difference between colonel and lieutenant versus lieutenant. Now, colonel was in the book. The weird spelling of colonel, like the military rank, the strange pronunciation came from the use of French and Italian military manuals over the centuries. A long history of the word colonel, colonel. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Mental health care can be difficult for many patients. It can be hard to properly diagnose the issues a person is dealing with, and in some cases even harder to find a proper treatment. The field of psychiatry has a long history of these struggles to identify and treat mental illness over the last 200 years, with mixed results at times and some shocking and traumatic treatments along the way. In a new book, our next guest documents that troubled history and how it shapes the way we treat mental illness today. He says there's no single solution for many people facing the most difficult kinds of mental illness, but there are changes we could and should make. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience yourself with mental health treatment? Did you find success with the methods you tried? Are you a caregiver, maybe for someone in your family who's dealing with some kind of severe mental illness? What kind of help do they and do you need. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Scull is a distinguished professor of sociology emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. His new book is called Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
There's a running theme in your book of kind of overconfidence at different periods of history. In the early 1800s, asylums were going to cure 80% of mental illness. Then nerve tonics, then Freudian psychotherapy, then biology and pills, then cognitive behavioral therapy. You write in your conclusion, humility and open-mindedness are deeply desirable qualities that are in short supply. That seems like one of the main points in your book. Do we need more humility in the scope of psychiatry?
Yes, I think we do. And I think as well, we need to beware of trumpeted statements that the cure is at hand. Unfortunately, there have been many of those in the past, as you've just illustrated very briefly. And all too often, with experience, we've learned that far from being helpful, they've often turned out to be extremely harmful. It's not that there's been no progress in the field, but we have no psychiatric penicillin. And even today, if you ask, do we understand where depression comes from, why people experience bipolar disorder, how is it that people become schizophrenic? The honest answer to that is we simply don't know. So we're kind of groping in the dark. We have some treatments that help symptomatically. They often come with a serious price to be paid for whatever relief they provide. And they're certainly far from being the kind of interventions that we'd like to see, since the degree of suffering of people with mental illness, and of course, the suffering of those around them trying to cope with the devastation this causes, is quite enormous. And so this is a very fraught area. Mental illness is far more widespread than we often think, until it affects ourselves or one of our loved ones or somebody we're close to. So this is an enormous problem. It's compounded by the stigma that seems to attach to the mentally ill and also to a degree to the professionals who try to treat them. And it remains a great mystery, I think, despite 200 years and large amounts of money being plowed into research. We're a long way from seeing solutions, which isn't to say there aren't things we could do better than we're presently doing. But being a little skeptical, exhibiting a certain amount of humility in the face of what is an awful set of problems is, I think, absolutely one of the keys to advancing from our present state.
You tell a 200-year story. I want to start a little more recently. The move, what did it start, 4 or 5 decades ago, to go from large-scale institutionalization of people with more severe mental illness to something else. And often you write very poorly thought out something else. Can you talk about that process and what it's meant for what we see today?
Yes, indeed. It's important to note that for about 100, 125 years, the United States, like most of the developed world, embraced the idea that the major solution to this, the problems of serious mental illness, was to lock people up in what were first thought to be therapeutic institutions. And that was founded in an atmosphere of great optimism about what these places could accomplish. By the end of the 19th century, that optimism had almost completely disappeared. And yet numbers institutionalized continued to grow very steadily. About 400,000, the outbreak of World War II, 500,000 people in mental hospitals in a given day in 1950, about 560,000 in the mid-50s. And then slowly at first, and then quite abruptly from the late 1960s onwards, we abandoned that whole approach. And that came about in part by a rising tide of criticism of the mental hospitals as warehouses for unwanted people, as places that were anti-therapeutic by their very nature, that systematically dehumanized both their patients and staff. So there was a real rise in the criticism and a lot of journalistic exposés of the sad state of America's mental hospitals. Right after World War II, journalists who had visited Nazi Germany and seen the death camps, Dachau and Belsen and Buchenwald, came back here and visited America's back wards of its mental hospitals and described them in the words of one of the journalists as America's own death camps. So the reputation of mental hospitals fell drastically, and particularly from the 1960s forward, there was an argument that communities would be receptive to the mentally ill, that we had new treatments, particularly the new drugs that had come on the scene in the early 1950s, and that community care could substitute for institutionalization, and that would be a grand reform. It also not so incidentally promised to save a lot of money. Mental hospitals absorbed huge fractions of state budgets in the early 1950s. In New York State, for example, about 30% of the state current budget was spent on its mental hospitals. That was a huge slice of the money that states were spending. But the reality was that the community wasn't terribly receptive to the return of the mentally ill. The drugs were at best a very partial fix, and for many patients, they didn't work at all. And there was no real infrastructure built in the community to cope with the needs of people with serious mental illness. Housing, social supports, some respite care, for example, for families, all of those things were largely missing. And in the excitement over getting rid of the snake pits, as a famous film of the 1940s had it, everybody assumed that anything that replaced the asylums had to be better. And we've learned from bitter experience that that's not the case. I split my time between San Francisco and San Diego, and I occasionally visit LA and New York City, and everywhere I go, the problem of homelessness, and while that's not exclusively a problem of the mentally ill, a large fraction of those on the streets are suffering from serious mental illness. And what we've created is a system where many patients move from the gutter to the flop house to the jail. Occasional contact with psychiatry for the prescription of drugs, which they often don't take, and then back out into the street, and the whole cycle repeats and perpetuates itself with horrible consequences for the lives of those people, and also severe consequences for our general well-being and the state of our cities and even our rural communities as these problems fester and multiply.
Talking to Andy Scull, author of the book Desperate Remedies: Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Whitewater. Tom, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My concern with this topic is just that this has touched my family before, and I currently belong to a number of support communities in Wisconsin where people are experiencing this. And the lack of a whole body look at mental illness is something that's come up more than once. A number of the people that I've talked with who have finally gotten help, when they were dealing with mainstream medicine, no one ever looked to see, did you have a brain injury before? Do you have food allergies? Do you have chemical sensitivities? Is there some other biochemical cause for your mental illness difficulties? They were simply placed on prescription medications to suppress their symptoms with the hope that it would do something, and they didn't achieve recovery that way. It wasn't until there was a more whole body approach that they actually got stable and got some help.
Tom, thanks for the call. Andy, what do you think?
Well, I would agree. Psychiatry has, in the last four decades or so, become increasingly dependent on pharmaceuticals, on drugs as the sole and singular response to the problem of mental illness. And I think it's much more multifaceted than that. I would respectfully disagree a bit with the caller in the sense that I do think that we simply don't know enough about the origins of mental illness to confidently say, oh, it's diet, oh, it's stress, oh, it's abnormal brain biochemistry. It seems to me this is an enormously fraught and poorly understood area, but I would agree with him that coping with the problem has to go beyond simply prescribing antipsychotics or antidepressants, has to take account of the social circumstances of the person and of the family, very often who is trying to cope with an enormously stressful situation. So in that sense, the pressure to adopt a broader approach to the problems of mental illness is one I would heartily endorse.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Andy Scull. His new book is Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. You can join in with your questions for our guest, maybe share your own experiences as someone dealing with mental illness and trying to find treatment, a family member, or a treatment provider. What support do you need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Andy Scull, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California, San Diego, talking about his new book, Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Madison. Nancy, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to thank the professor for being on today, and I just want to say I'm a one of the founding members of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the founding president of NAMI Wisconsin, and a founder of NAMI Dane County. One of the things that it is important, I think, to be discussed is the implementation of assertive community programs. And PACT, the Program of Assertive Community Treatment, out of Mendota, here in Madison, Wisconsin, is celebrating its 50th year. My son is a client of that program. That is, in a sense, a wraparound program, which has shown, it's demonstrated through the decades, what it can do to help individuals with serious and persistent mental illness in the community. And I would say the track record has been excellent. My son is now 66 and a half. He worked for 20 years part-time at the Mental Health Center. He gave over 750 educational talks about mental illness. He has been, quote-unquote, compliant with medications through 48 years and 45 years as a client of PACT. So we do know how to treat persons quite effectively within the community, and it has been demonstrated and continues to be demonstrated here in Wisconsin, and there are assertive community treatment programs around the country.
Nancy, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. And Andy, you write, you know, sometimes we focus on, will this pill cure or this version of talk therapy cure someone? You also, I think, want to see more focus on community and helping people, even if they're not quote-unquote cured, live good lives in a community.
Absolutely. Nancy, thank you for that call. And indeed, you know, we certainly need more in the way of community support programs of the sort you describe. Wisconsin actually modeled quite early on in the deinstitutionalization process some of these programs. And as model programs, they were quite successful, at least if one can rely on the published data. The problem is that these sorts of supports are in incredibly short supply across the country. So people who are fortunate enough to get those kinds of services may do rather well. But as a general principle, this is not what people with severe mental illness experience, or their families come to that. So yes, more social supports, more help with sheltered housing, more help with the sense of social isolation that often accompanies mental illness. All of these things would be a distinct step forward from the situation we face now.
Nancy, thanks for that call. We'll go to Virginia now in Milwaukee. Virginia, hi.
Hi to both of you. I'm so really grateful that I just came into my apartment and heard you on the radio, and I thought, I definitely have to get in on this conversation. My daughter is, she just did turn 63, and she looks like she's about 55 or something. I guess we just have that youthful look in her family. I don't know. But she was headstrong to be a model. And I have her beautiful professional modeling picture in her room. She's in a group home, and this is the thing that has saved her. She was like so many other people who have this, I call it a monster on your back. And you can't get it off, but you can tame it. And how they tamed it with her, fortunately, the medical community, with trial and error through the years, have found that some medication does work. And of course, it's also the talk therapy, I think, too. So she had a fall, and it was a life-threatening fall. So she, you might say, she was dead and hit her head on the cement. And she was living at large, you know, like some of the people were turned out from the behavioral health here in Milwaukee. And for whatever reason, thought that they could live on their own. And, of course, my daughter could not. She always got herself into some kind of problems or whatever with other people or whatever.
I understand, Virginia. We don't have too much time left. But Virginia says the solution, Andy, wasn't medicine or talk therapy or a group home. It was a combination of a lot of different things. And it sounds like a long time of trial and error.
Well, I think trial and error is an accurate assessment of what we often confront, professionals confront in trying to deal with mental illness. There are a wide range of medications out there. All of them have both some advantages and a great deal of drawbacks. Which one is going to suit a particular patient is hard to know in advance. And the same thing is true of forms of talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and the alternatives to it. So, you know, in the face of a great deal of lack of knowledge about how to proceed, one does the best one can. And indeed, I think that's an accurate assessment of how things go. For many patients, unfortunately, none of these interventions work very well. If you're fortunate, and I hope this caller's daughter is fortunate in that respect, things are better than they otherwise might be. But we all would love the day where we had a cure for these awful conditions. Unfortunately, we're not there yet.
Virginia, thanks for that call. Andy, we have just a minute or so left. There isn't a magic cure for many forms of mental illness. There's not a magic cure for the system. But if there were one change you could communicate to people who, you know, provide the funding, what would it be? What is the most important element that we could change right now?
I think for the last 40 years, particularly the last two decades, there's been a singular emphasis on the biological dimensions of mental illness that unfortunately has had very little in the way of actual therapeutic payoff. So what I'd like to see is a more broad focus on how we proceed from here that takes account of the environmental, of the social, and of the psychological, as well as continuing to do basic research, because for certain forms of serious mental illness, I would be astonished if they didn't turn out to be a biological component, but we don't know what that component is right now. And putting all our eggs in one basket is a bad recipe, I think.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
That's Andrew Scull, Distinguished Professor of Sociology Emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He joins us today to share his research, his latest book. It's called Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness, looking at over 200 years of mental health treatment in the United States, the promises, and where it's gone wrong. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, while the world is focused on Ukraine, there are concerns about China's actions and threats against Taiwan, with a big role in the situation for the United States. We'll find out what's going on in the news this week and what it all means for U.S. foreign policy and for our economy. And Mount Horeb is Wisconsin's home for trolls and not the internet kind. But why is that? We'll get the answer with a new Why Wisconsin answer to a listener question about Norwegian culture here in Wisconsin. You'll want to hear that for sure. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.